Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thanks so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, we continue our reporting on the dramatic spikes that NYSEG customers have been seeing in their electric bills this winter. We talked to some of those customers who are starting to take drastic measures to combat the sky-high energy bills, some even turning off their heat entirely. Kimberly Izar has that story in the second half of the program. But first, we've got breaking news from the Times Union. I spoke to Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley, earlier this afternoon. All right, Philip, welcome back to the local edition.
Always good to be with you.
So we've got some news that you just broke this morning, and it's pretty big and impactful for our area. And this is news that Catholic Charities, which operates in Orange and Sullivan County, they'll be cutting their staff and then also cutting back on treatment programs?
Yeah, that's right. So here at the Times Union, we have a scraper that monitors when layoff notices are filed to the State Department of Labor, which companies are required to do if there's a sizable number of layoffs. And so we noticed this one just the other day. Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster is going to lay off 33 people starting in May. And those are going to be phased layoffs pretty much throughout the summer, ending on August 15th, according to the notice. And that notice doesn't provide why this is happening or any other details. So we did a little bit of reporting, and we were told that this is coming because they are ending their chemical dependency treatment programs and stopping admissions at those clinics in Goshen, Newburgh, Port Jervis, and Monticello. I think there are two in Monticello. So, definitely big news.
Were you able to get a statement from Catholic Charities on this?
Yeah, so what the chapter CEO told us was that this difficult decision comes as we face a critical staffing shortage and an evolving healthcare landscape that has made the continuation of care increasingly challenging. They also said that they would commit to transferring clients who are currently enrolled in treatment to the appropriate level of care at other local providers so that there would be no interruption in their treatment and recovery support.
And what's interesting there, you know, the evolving healthcare landscape and increasingly challenging situation to continue the care that they're bringing. Nothing in that statement really says anything about a financial issue, which was the first thing that I thought of is like, well, what's their funding like? And especially right now when we're across the country looking at different people are losing funding, at least from federal sources, potentially. So that stood out to me. Have you this is breaking news, brand new news. Is there any reaction yet from folks?
We haven't had any real reaction yet. When we first saw this notice, we thought it might have something to do with federal funding as well. It's worth noting that the National Catholic Charities chapter has been urging President Donald Trump to reconsider his administration's order to freeze federal aid to nonprofit organizations, which, you know, that order was rescinded shortly thereafter. And a lot of other local Catholic Charities chapters have reportedly laid off employees and shut down programs, particularly refugee resettlement programs or programs that provide legal services to immigrants. Though in this case, the Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster chapter did say that all of the other programs and services that it provides, including immigration legal services, community outreach, food and housing assistance, case management, all of those are going to continue.
And part of the background to this is just the seriousness of drug addiction, especially in our region, especially in Sullivan County. The listener may be familiar with Bill Williams, who hosts our monthly Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction. And he's very plugged into the recovery community and the treatment communities. He was just at a conference down in the cities last week. When I sent him this article, he just sent along a quick notice saying like, hey, at this conference last Friday in Columbia down in the city, any statistics that were available on Sullivan County still had it as the absolute worst in the state including New York City. And Bill Williams said, quote, "This is horrible news." That's his reaction there. Also, our reporter Kimberly Izar reporting from the Sullivan County Legislature this morning. County coroner said that they're seeing a huge surge in xylazine mixed with fentanyl causing overdoses. There's been a 38% increase of xylazine overdoses. That's the backdrop here, is just how serious this issue is for Sullivan County.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you know, and I'm sure most of the listeners to Radio Catskill know that Sullivan County has been among the hardest hit regions, by some measures, the hardest hit region in the state from the opioid crisis. You know, just one example there, the rate of people who died or hospitalized due to overdoses is more than twice the statewide rate. So this is an area that perhaps least equipped to lose these services, or another way of saying that most needs them.
All right. Well, thank you so much for this reporting. And it comes from your colleague, Maria Silva, who's been, you know, covering our area. Are you guys going to stay on the story, I assume?
Yeah, certainly we're going to, you know, we're doing a little bit more reporting to try to figure out what the plan is for Catholic Charities to move some of those people who are in treatment to other programs like they said they would do, and then what some of the local reaction will be. So I hope we'll have something on that by next week.
And we'll also be continuing to cover it here as well. We have another story about loss of services or potential loss of services in the Hudson Valley. And this one is definitely connected to the shakeups happening in Washington, D.C. They're having ripples across the country because Poughkeepsie's Social Security office is on the DOGE list. So what's the status of the Social Security Administration in Poughkeepsie?
Yeah, it's not entirely clear. So that office closed in January for temporary renovations. And that was kind of the last anybody knew until last week, when several constituents of Congressman Pat Ryan alerted him to the fact that it had showed up on a DOGE cost savings list. Now, people have probably heard about this website. This is the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, the quasi-governmental initiative being run by Elon Musk, allegedly run by Elon Musk, I guess I should say. Because right. The debate over whether he's actually in charge of it. That is going through and, you know, trying to improve the efficiency of governmental operations by cutting costs. And that's where a bunch of the layoffs that you've heard about are coming from. A week or so ago, DOGE created a website where they were basically just listing all of the savings that they were presumably creating for the government, like it's contracts, it's real estate leases, it's other subcontracts. It's basically things that they're now cutting, right? And you can open it up, each one and see how much you're allegedly saving, or they're allegedly saving the government. And then there's like a big number at the top. Now, sidebar, like the journalists who have been looking at that list have found that there's just sort of basic mathematical errors or things that are on the list that, you know, were cut under the Biden administration, whatever. So don't take that number for what it's worth. But the Poughkeepsie office showed up there, which sort of by definition means that it's supposed to be
on the chopping block, basically.
On the chopping block, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that the Social Security Administration would be giving up the lease to the office. Now, Congressman Pat Ryan was not able to get an answer about what was happening there. We got kind of an answer. They basically told us that that they are reviewing the leases and ensuring they are used efficiently, and added that most of the leases they have that they are not renewing are for small remote hearing sites that share space with federal offices. The Poughkeepsie office doesn't share space with another federal office, but it is a smaller, like more remote hearing site. The Social Security Administration further told us that most Social Security hearings are held virtually and that they don't need as many in-person locations. So, you know, they did not at all commit to reopening the Poughkeepsie office, and they essentially described the rationale for closing it. But this would be kind of a big deal because there was another Social Security Administration office down in White Plains that is also closing. That was the sort of scheduled close. Everybody knew that was happening. And there was previously one in Newbury that has since moved to Middletown. If the Poughkeepsie office closes, there won't be any between Middletown and Hudson, which leaves like a wide swath of people. And the Poughkeepsie office, I think, actually did have a lot of foot traffic because it's right in the middle of town. Poughkeepsie is, you know, is the biggest city in the Mid-Hudson Valley. It's the place probably where the services are most needed and where people might not have access to transportation to get to, say, Middletown or Hudson. So certainly something that people who are affected by this and then others who are just acting as governmental watchdogs are watching closely.
Has there been any reaction from just general members of the public or people that use the facility?
Yeah. So on Tuesday, employees who work there and the public came out for a rally to basically try to save the office. You know, several dozen people, maybe a little over 100 were there. So there's certainly a demand to keep it open. But we don't have any more clarity yet from the federal government. And, you know, they could tell us one thing tomorrow and do another thing the next day. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Next up, I see you got a story about one of the trials that you're following. What's the update?
Yeah, so this is the long-awaited murder trial. Edward Holly, who was charged with killing Megan McDonald back in 2003. So I've talked a lot about this case, really probably for a couple of years now, on the Local Edition. But just to remind people, this has been one of the more prominent murder cases in Orange County, really across the whole Hudson Valley for more than two decades. In 2003, young Megan McDonald, she was 20 at the time, her body was found in the town of Walk Hill. And there have been, you know, there's been an ongoing investigation really since then. The case was never considered cold, but a suspect was never arrested until, that is, in 2023. When state police arrested and charged Edward Holly. So you might be wondering, okay, that happened in the summer of 2023. Why are we just now getting to a trial in March of 2025? Well, that's because there was friction between state police and the Orange County District Attorney's Office. Kind of too much to go into there, but basically there was a lot of bad blood and mistrust between them, and the Orange County District Attorney ended up recusing himself from prosecuting the case because he had represented another person of interest to police when he was in private practice. That person has since died. And so Edward Holly actually got released. Special prosecutors came in. They had to present the case to a grand jury and go through the whole sort of indictment process again. That happened last year, and the indictment alleges that Holly did not act alone. Again, though, no one else has been charged, and a prior person of interest has since passed away. Now, there's been a kind of month-long pre-trial hearing that I've probably talked about a little bit. Holly has long been a, if not quite a suspect, a person of interest to police. And they've brought him in on unrelated charges or even unrelated, not even charges, just like, you know, brought him into the police station to ask him questions. And on four different occasions over the last two decades. And eventually they would get around to talking about the Megan McDonald murder and see if he would kind of let anything slip. All of those interviews were recorded. And there was this long pretrial hearing to essentially determine whether those would be admissible as evidence because they weren't actually conducted as part of an investigation into the murder. That's kind of what's been hanging up the trial for the past, couple of months. But it finally got underway today, this week on Monday. Jury selection's been going on all this week, and Arlena Bellamy has been in the courtroom. She's basically going to be living at the Orange County Courthouse for the next 6 weeks because this trial is going to be 4 days a week, full days. So it's going to be, a big story for us. And it's going to get underway kind of in earnest, I would say, on Monday. As of yesterday, they had selected about a third of the jury. They're expected to finish that up today. And then on Monday, the sides will deliver their opening statements.
And they really expect this to go on for at least 6 weeks?
Yeah, apparently. That's what we're hearing from the defense attorney. That's also how much it's been booked out right now in the court calendar. It's possible it will go shorter than that. But we don't have this in the story yet. We'll probably have it in the story tomorrow. But I think there are something like 50 witnesses on the prosecution, like witness list that they could conceivably call. And I expect the defendant himself, Edward Holly, who's now in his 40s, he was a friend and former romantic partner of Megan McDonald. He'll almost certainly testify as well, and he'll probably be up on the stand for multiple days.
Finally, we have one last story to get to, and listener, I gotta let you know that this is a rather unpleasant, even horrific type of story, and it does involve sexual abuse of minors and other pretty gruesome stuff here. So I'm just letting you know that in case that's something that you would not like to hear. But Philip, this is all about a prominent local chiropractor, right?
Yeah. Horrific is right. This is a story that I covered myself earlier this week. I got a tip that a chiropractor named John Boyle, who he and his wife run, a fairly popular and prominent chiropractic clinic in Uptown Kingston, were being arraigned in Kingston City Court on several child sex abuse material counts. Now, this relates to the possession and the promotion, and I'll get into what that means in a minute, of child sex abuse material or child pornography involving kids that might be as young as 4. And without getting into too many details here, some of the material that was found on Boyle's laptop and phone involves animals and dead people. So it's really a pretty shocking discovery here. This case really began back in October when the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children passed a tip along to state police. They began investigating at that point. They executed a search warrant in late October where they arrested the wife, and at the time charged her with a couple of counts of possession of this material. Boyle himself was not arrested until this week and then brought into Kingston City Court to be arraigned. At that time, the wife, they added an additional charge of promoting this material as well. Now, what promoting really means in the state criminal statute here is it's essentially that they were... that they produced this child sex abuse material. So, and it often, often you produce it with the intent to distribute. Now that would be a separate charge, but right now the Ulster County District Attorney's Office and the state police are continuing their investigation. They're going to present their findings at some point to a grand jury, which will then, decide whether or not they want to hand up an indictment. At that point, there could be additional charges that are added, and I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up being a federal case because of allegedly some of the material that was found was produced in other states. So we've got an issue here of jurisdiction and of crossing state lines. But this is going to be a pretty big case. It seems like, this is what police and prosecutors are saying anyway. These folks allegedly were kind of at the center of of a pretty sort of disgusting operation. And you know, we'll be having to keep an eye on that.
All right. Absolutely. Well, Philip, thank you for bringing us this news today. These stories are all up now at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley. Philip, thank you again.
You got it. Take care.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It's The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And as we've been reporting, NYSEG and other electricity customers have experienced dramatic spikes in their electric bills this winter, with accounts of bills that are 2 to 3 times higher than normal. And some NYSEG customers have taken drastic measures in recent months to combat these sky-high energy bills, unplugging every appliance before bed, layering up instead of turning the thermostat above 60, and some even turning off their heat entirely. Radio Catskill's newest reporter, Kimberly Izart, spoke to some of these customers about how they are coping with the unexpectedly high bills.
It was as low as 8 degrees in Sydney, New York this week, where Julie James lives. Despite the freezing temperatures, Julie says she's keeping the heating off in her apartment due to her high NYSEG electricity bill.
Absolutely no exaggeration. I have no heat on in my apartment. I've been sitting in winter coats in my living room because of the fact that I can't afford heat.
Julie is one of many NYSEG customers who want answers for increased electricity bills they receive this winter. Many have reached out to Radio Catskill with stories that their bills have doubled, tripled, and in Julie's case, spike nearly 5 times the amount she's used to. Her bill jumped from $116 in December to almost $500 the following month.
I haven't had heat on since December 24th, since right before Christmas. I haven't had heat on in my apartment.
Julie lives in public housing and qualifies for the Home Energy Assistance Program, or HEAP, which assists low-income New Yorkers with their energy costs, though she's not sure if that'll be enough to pay her bills.
My rent is subsidized, and I pay $623 in rent. And then I have to pay an electric bill that's over $500, and my husband works overnight stock in a supermarket. I'm disabled. There's not much money coming into my house.
Right.
They recently took the food stamps away because they said he's working too much.
Shelby Cohen, communications director at NYSEG, told Radio Catskill that a combination of extreme cold weather and rising supply costs set by energy generators are the reason for the high bills. She added that NYSEG did not have control of the supply costs that show up on customers' bills. Julie is not convinced and thinks it's NYSEG's responsibility to look into how to lower costs for their customers. She recently joined a Facebook group called NYSEG Needs to be Held Accountable, which has more than 13,000 members. Since then, Julie has reached out to a few other agencies for support.
I've been calling other places, like we called the PSC and the Better Business Bureau. I left a complaint in a number for the White House.
Normina Schneider, a NYSEG customer in Monticello, was also shocked when she received her bill back in 2022. She thought it was a mistake.
We had gotten an unexpected bill that was $3,000 to $4,000. And we're like, what the heck is this, you know?
Normina said NYSEG initially removed the $4,000 bill to investigate the charge, but then tacked it back onto her bill in December 2023.
They just kept threatening me, telling me, you know, everything looks fine on our end. You've got to either, you know, make a payment arrangement or we're shutting you off. And I'm like, I've got children, like, and I've also had some health problems that's been going on. I'm like, there's no way, you know, I can pay this amount of bill like that.
Normina and Julie were upset by NYSEG's lack of empathy when they reached out for support and the consequences these bills will have on their futures.
They didn't even have any remorse of anything. Like, they just basically, like, you know, it's your bill, you're stuck with it. Like, you have to pay it. If you, you know, don't make these arrangements, don't pay it. You know, I'm basically SOL, excuse me, but yeah.
This bill's going to follow me when I move, and I could then be told that they won't turn my electric on when I move because I owe all this money.
Last Thursday, New York State Assembly member Paula Kay arranged a public meeting with NYSEG representatives at the Sullivan County Government Center in Monticello. More than 100 people attended to share their concerns and have their questions answered. but many left unsatisfied and still confused with what they heard. Julie said that local governments need to step up.
I just feel like we need a voice. So I feel like if anything, the government should, like the officials in our area should be our voice, not trying to tax us and raise these prices.
But Normina in Monticello says she has yet to see local agencies taking responsibility.
They should have our back. They should be, you know, standing up for us. And I'm not seeing much of that either.
Reporting for Radio Catskill, I'm Kimberly Izar.
And thank you, Kimberly, for that report. And I'm not just saying that to the person on the tape, because that person, Kimberly Izar, is actually here in the studio with me. I'm saying thank you in person. Thank you for that report, Kimberly.
Of course, Jason. Thanks so much for bringing me in.
And I'm also bringing you here because I do want to introduce you to the listeners. This is your debut on the Local Edition.
Debut? And, here we go.
And that spot debuted this morning on Radio Chatskill as well. And you are our new reporter. You're the new addition to our news team here at Radio Catskill. And Monday was your first day.
It was. And I just want to start off by saying how excited and honored I am really to cover this region. I'm very, very excited.
That's great. You know, I'm excited that you're here because, like, again, we got that great reporting. We can hear like what folks are saying, so we can start to dig even deeper into the stories that we bring people here because we got more folks on the team. Do you want to tell people a little bit about yourself or where you come from?
Sure. So I'm originally from Jersey City in New Jersey, but I actually spent my high school years in the 845. So it is very exciting to be back in the area. I'm spent some time in Rockland County, and I think there's so many reasons why I'm excited to be here. I think first off, I am really proud to be part of public media. I think community radio stations like WJFF Radio Catskill is really the backbone of a community's news infrastructure. And I think second, wow, just to be able to report on a region like the Catskills is really a dream. There's so many opportunity here to help meet people's information needs, and I'm really thrilled to be here. I'm coming from reporting in Essex County, New Jersey, where obviously very different region in the Northeast, but I think have similar issues to here. You know, healthcare inequities for vulnerable residents, environmental justice issues, and obviously people caring deeply about what governments are doing in the state and what government accountability should look like. So really excited to be digging into that with you and the whole team and, you know, with the region.
And in your past work, I know you reported on things like food insecurity, urban farming, land access, you know, and you're interested in climate reporting, social justice issues, and food and land access. And these are all things that I'm very much interested in here, and that's what I'm excited to do. You're going to be looking into issues like that here in our area?
Absolutely. You know, we just heard of NYSEG customers sharing the pretty dramatic ways that they're adjusting their life, their daily life, to live. And we have a couple exciting stories that we'll be hearing from next week, the impact of bird flu or avian flu on local farmers, also thinking about what federal funding freezes, how that will be impacting local farmers in the region, specifically looking at like DEI federal funding freezes as well. So there's a lot more to come.
Speaking of freezes, you also moved up here to our area in the winter.
I sure did.
You know, people say like the song or like about New York City, they're like, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. And I said, like, no, if you can make it through a winter in Sullivan County, like then you can make it anywhere. So good on you for braving the cold up here.
Well, thank you. I think I also came at a good time. It's just starting to warm up.
Kimberly Izar, welcome to the team and thank you so much for helping us.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole, and I won't be back here tomorrow. Patricio will be your host for your Friday Local Edition, then I'll be back on Monday. Stay with us tonight, of course. Coming up, we've got our great music programming kicking off with Ramble Tamble at 7. And before that, we've got more news from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together. Committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Donald Trump, Russia, and the endgame for Ukraine. All next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6.